Okay. I've been asked by the organizers to give a talk on other, by other we always mean anything other than Super K, atmospheric neutrino experiments from the past, the present, and the future. That's quite a broad range, so I have to make some judicious choices of what to discuss here. So I won't spend too much time talking about the past, other than to point out how far we've actually come. And I think perhaps we've gotten spoiled by the beautiful data that we've been seeing from SNOW and Super K and Camland in the last 5 or 6 years, to go back in time to remember that there was quite a long stretch of time from really the late 80s until really the late 90s where we knew something was funny with atmospheric neutrinos. If you look at the most basic statistic that we have, which is a fairly robust prediction for the ratio of muon to electron events you expect versus what you see compared to what you expect, where this ratio should be 1 for no oscillations. There were a number of experiments which had very statistically significant deviations from 1, but without any additional handles on what was the issue, people found it very hard to believe that this was something like neutrino oscillations, although that was, you know, certainly suggested. And I would say that, you know, having worked on this during part of this time frame, that skepticism was rampant. And if you asked people what their skepticism was based on, you would hear quite a variety of different answers. And people would sometimes say, well, you know, neutrino experiments are very hard, and cosmic ray experiments are very hard, and oscillation experiments are very hard, with the implication that if you're trying to do an oscillation experiment using cosmic ray-induced neutrinos, you just didn't really have a chance. But with the Super K data, and prior to that, even the Kamioka data, there's very clear evidence that there is something going on in the flux that's suggestive of oscillations, and really started to turn the community into believing that this may be the case. So in this talk, I'll focus on the current experiments, but try to wrap up a little bit, if we have time, with a question for the future, which is that now that neutrino oscillations have basically been established, is there still a role for atmospheric neutrinos to play in our experimental study of neutrino oscillations? Okay. It's very hard to sort of define, historical periods because things are never completely clear-cut. But I think we can sort of generalize the experimental questions that people have been asking about atmospheric neutrinos and put them into two categories. The first set of questions really relates to confirming our idea that this is really neutrino oscillations and not something else. And if you're willing to set aside the LS&D result, people have, a particular bias that the standard picture of neutrino oscillations is something like mixing between 3 active flavors. There's no sterile mixing. There's no CPT violation. And that the neutrino masses are small via the seesaw mechanism. So the goals that these ideas set out for experimenters are, first you want to confirm the oscillations signatures with multiple independent measurements particularly from different experiments. You want to be able to actually observe oscillations. As Ed was just showing us, you want to be able to see the dip and the rise corresponding to the first oscillation maximum. And if you think what we're seeing in atmospheric neutrinos is nu mu to nu tau, then certainly at some point you want to be able to see nu taus in the atmospheric neutrino flux if you can. And you want to do your best to rule out things like mixing to sterile neutrinos, and there are a number of suggestions as to ways that one could do that we haven't looked at yet, but ruling out mixing to sterile neutrinos as much as one can, and also trying to rule out the various alternative hypotheses that people have put forward over the years. Okay. Well, in terms of the current experiments other than Super K, in addition to the goal of measuring delta M squared and sine squared 2 theta as well as you can, and focusing on some of these questions that I just mentioned, I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the Sudan 2 and macro results because these experiments are no longer running. So these represent the final or maybe the nearly final analyses from each of these experiments. And then spend a little less time talking about the Minos and SNOW results. And these are, really just getting underway. So these are sort of preliminary analyses for atmospheric neutrinos. Okay. The Sudan 2 detector is an iron tracking calorimeter. It's located 2,300 feet underground in a state park in northern Minnesota. It weighed just a little less than a kiloton. And it ran from 1989 to about 2000, 2001. And in that time, took a 5.9 fiducial kiloton year exposure. The detector is modular. These modules are each 1 meter by 1 meter by 2.7 meters. So the detector is sort of stacked in building block fashion. And there are 224 modules in total. The detector is surrounded by a 1,700 square meter veto shield, which allowed you to tag various backgrounds that you could then use to do the background subtraction for neutral particles entering the detector. In terms of atmospheric neutrinos, there are a number of different samples that one can look at. The most basic, in some ways the easiest, are contained events, which have a sort of a peak energy distribution of around 1 GeV. Here, the neutrino interacts somewhere in your detector, and everything stays inside your Fedusha volume. There's also a sample of partially contained events where the interaction is also in your detector, but there's a muon coming out. These are usually accompanied by a hit in the Vito shield surrounding the detector. And then there are two categories of events that in some cases are difficult to distinguish from each other. One is where a neutrino interacts in the detector and sends a muon into the bottom, out the bottom of the detector with a hit in the Vito shield. And another is where you have neutrinos interacting below the detector and sending muons up into the detector. And again, these samples, as Ed was showing, have slightly different energy distributions, not nearly the dynamic range that he was talking about for Super K, but still maybe a factor of 5 between this lowest energy sample and this highest energy one down here. The events, the modules have a stacked of 1.6 millimeter thick steel sheets into which are inserted high-trail drift tubes. So it's basically gives you very good imaging capabilities in both the X and Y planes with corresponding to the readout on the anodes and the cathodes, and in the Z direction here, which you get from the drift time. The events are placed into flavor categories based largely on a physicist scan. And you can see that clearly here, this is a muon neutrino charge current interaction. There's a decay at the end here with some inelastic activity. And here, a new E quasi-elastic event, leaving a very nice electromagnetic shower and a recoil proton at the vertex, which you can also identify based on its ionization. The events are placed into two bins of resolution based on the energy of the event and the topology of the event. The data are corrected for some neutral backgrounds. Okay. Well, in terms of the fits, the data are subdivided into these various categories. All the electron tagged events are put into one bin over here, and so this is on a log scale that basically provides normalization to the atmospheric neutrino flux. And the plot up here is the L over E distribution for the events that are tagged as being muon flavor and fully contained. And you can see that the data here, which are here, the crosses, disagree with the no oscillation curve, which is the green dashed histogram here, and agrees quite well with the best fit for the oscillation parameter, which I'll come to in a minute. You can also construct the flavor ratio, as Ed was just describing as well, and the flavor identification for the events based on the true flavor in the columns in the rows here versus the tagged flavor of the events is quite good, and you can make a small correction for misidentification to get this flavor ratio here. Okay. In terms of determining the oscillation parameters from this data, Feldman-Cousins analysis is performed, which is described in this publication. Nu mu to nu tau oscillations are assumed. This is the likelihood contour corresponding to the minimum down here. And this is actually, it maybe looks a little bit more peaked than it is, but this is actually not terribly steep down in this region. This is all quite consistent with the data. The flux normalization and some parameters related to the amount of background in the various samples are allowed to float and are independently determined at each point in this parameter space. In the context of a Feldman-Cousins analysis, you can incorporate your systematic errors through what are called nuisance parameters. So a number of those are put into the fit related to the energy calibration, the uncertainty in the shape of the flux, the E to mu ratio, and the ratio of quasi-elastic to inelastic cross-sections. And this is the allowed region in parameter space from the SUDAN2 data. The 90% confidence interval is given here in the brown, and this dashed curve on the outside is the Feldman-Cousins sensitivity. So the difference between that and this brown region sort of indicates the extent to which we were lucky. This dashed line here, just in terms of the statistics of this, is what one would get if one naively took the likelihood contour and just took a delta of 2.3. So the difference between that and this brown region reflects the inclusion of systematic errors in the application of the Feldman-Cousins technique to the fits. Best fit point is 5.2 times 10 to the minus 3 EV squared. And the sine squared 2 theta is basically maximal. In this last event category of upgoing muons, some work is underway to isolate a sample. That we have something like 45 events, and they're currently being analyzed. They have not yet been incorporated into the oscillation fits. But you can see, because one does not expect to have a lot of oscillation at the horizon for near the horizon for these kinds of events, there is some sensitivity in the shape to various delta M squareds. Okay, the macro detector is a 5.3 kiloton detector, which was located in the Grand Sasso Laboratory, running from 1989 to about 2000, over which time it collected about more than 40 cosmic ray muons, more like 40 million cosmic ray muons. There are three atmospheric neutrino samples, an upward through-going sample, a high-energy sample here, where you have three hits in these scintillator layers, which provide good timing at the level of nanoseconds, and streamer tubes, shown here in red, which provide excellent tracking. The energy distributions for these events are span, again, quite a dynamic range, with these upward through-going muons here sort of stretching from 10 up to a 10 JeV up to a TeV, whereas these other categories here, events, what's called the upstopping neutrino interactions below the detector, sending a muon up, which stops, the in-down neutrino interaction here, sending a muon down, and the in-up, which is a neutrino coming from the other side of the Earth, interacting in the detector and sending a muon up through these two scintillator layers. So these three categories have sort of similar energy distributions when compared to this high energy sample from the through-going muons. So if one looks at analyses of these first, what one quickly realizes is that the shape of the distribution is quite well known. The uncertainty on that is only around 5%, whereas the normalization is uncertain to around 25%. So you want to be independent, do fits that are independent of this normalization as much as possible. For the macro analyses, two independent analyses are carried out, which basically involve completely different tracking algorithms, which yield completely consistent results. And these are the fits to the shape, essentially, of the oscillation or of the data in terms of the zenith angle distributions, assuming the best fit point is sine squared 2 theta 1 and delta m squared of 2.3 times 10 to the minus 3. Now, we've just gotten used to seeing this data plotted as L over E or log L over E. And for this data, you can actually do that if one can estimate the energy. And this is a plot of the L over E ratio for these events, and in addition to the in-up data, which comes from a long way away, so it has a large L, which is shown in this last bin. So the question is, how has one actually estimated the energy for these through-going muons? And that's actually done from estimating the multiple Coulomb scattering on the tracks. This is a very clever technique that was calibrated in several test beam runs at the CERN PS and SPS. The muon energy is estimated based on a number of using a neural network based on a number of parameters related to the track fits. It has one hidden layer and a single output, which is related to the muon energy. And since you know there's a simple relationship generally between the muon energy and the neutrino energy, you can use that to give you an estimator of the neutrino energy, where you have a resolution of around 150%, which doesn't sound great, but is actually quite good when you're going to be plotting this data in terms of log 10 L over E. In order to optimize this technique, the streamer tubes were used in a drift mode, which gave one a coordinate resolution of around 3 millimeters. Shown here are the data compared to the Monte Carlo for several different muon energy runs in these test beams. And as you can see, the data in Monte Carlo are in quite good agreement. And the estimator is reasonably reliable. In terms of the low energy samples in macro, this in-up sample is identified by the topology as well as the time of flight. You have it going through the top two scintillator layers. And these up-stop and in-down samples are indistinguishable, but because they have the same topology. But one would expect naively that this up-stop sample is completely oscillated, so those are sort of like half gone, while this in-down sample is not oscillated at all. So one would expect this combined sample to maybe be depleted by 25%, this in-up sample to be depleted by something like 50%, and that roughly is what one sees when one plots the angular distribution of the data. Shown here is the flux prediction from the Fluke of Monte Carlo with the systematic uncertainty on it, and the solid lines here represent the best fit with the macro parameters. And because these two samples have very similar energy distributions, one can take the ratio of events in these two categories, and the systematic uncertainty on that is quite small. Okay. A number of Monte Carlo studies were carried out to look at statistics that gave one good sensitivity to oscillations. A number of them were constructed. One related to the upward through-going muon sample, the number of events in the vertical bin versus the horizontal bin, the number of low-energy and high-energy events, and the ratio I just mentioned. Those ratios are constructed, and they're shown here at the value corresponding to this best fit. And these are what one would expect as a function of delta m squared for these three ratios. And as you can see, the combination of these three give you some they have some different delta m squared dependence and sort of focus in on this region right here. There are a number of publications here, and these plots are in a soon-to-be published paper. Okay. In terms of parameter space, it's a chi-squared fit, again using the Feldman-Cousins technique. There are 10 bins based on the angular distribution of the upward through-going events. The number of events in this low and high energy sample, as well as these low energy samples. Since one is not wanting to rely too much on the normalization, one gives each of these samples, again, an independent normalization, which is allowed to float in the fit. So this is the region that one obtains. The best fit value is at the boundary with a delta m squared of 2.3 times 10 to the minus 3. And from this fit, one can also compare the alphas that one might determine with the nominal values from the flux normalization, which suggests an increase in the flux of an energy-dependent fashion of 12% at low energy and 25% at high energy. Because some of these ratios are very sensitive to matter effects, you can also exclude mixing to sterile neutrinos at 99.8% confidence level. Okay, well, in terms of the new kids on the block, there's the Minos detector. I won't spend a lot of time talking about Minos itself because there's a talk on it on Thursday. But for the purposes of atmospheric neutrinos, the only things that I'll need to mention is that it's a 5.4 kiloton detector. And it's alternating planes of scintillating strips with good timing and fairly good coordinate resolution and 1-inch thick steel plates. The plates are magnetized in a 1.5 Tesla magnetic field, which allows one to separate mu minus and mu plus and thereby identify neutrino and anti-neutrino interactions on an event-by-event basis. There are several different samples of events that one will be able to look at in Minos, and because of the good timing in the magnetic field, one has some redundancy in some of the measurements. The muon energy can be determined either by range or curvature, and the track direction from the timing or the curvature. If you think of the detector as being sort of a long cylinder, if you're looking at the front face here, here's an example of an incoming stopping muon. Actually, we'll start looking at this picture here. So this is looking at the side of the detector. And as you can see, I mean, even just from the curvature, this sort of looks like a fairly stiff track entering and you know, bending in the magnetic field and coming to stop right here, which is sort of confirmed when one looks at the front view of the detector. And indeed, when one looks at the timing, this is the Y position or the vertical position on this axis and the time here. So as time marches forward, the event is indeed climbing vertically. So Thursday's Minos talk will include two preliminary analyses of atmospheric neutrino events from data taken from September of 2002 to April of this year. There are a through-going muon sample and a contained event sample corresponding to 1.85 fiducial kiloton years. And just as a little teaser to convince you to stick around, because there really is some new physics results that will come out of this. This is a neutrino sky map from the approximately 45 through-going muons in the detector. Now, the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory is actually not just a solar neutrino detector. You can look at many other things with it as well. And in particular, for atmospheric neutrinos, it has one great advantage. That is, it's at such a deep mine that you have a very large overburden at the horizontal. And what this means is that you can do is that, as Ed was showing, the path length changes very quickly as one's near the horizon. And as a result, if one looks at the oscillation probability for sort of a nominal delta m squared in terms of 10 GeV and 100 GeV neutrinos, which maybe span the low energy end of what one might expect for these kinds of events. One sees that above the horizon, you basically expect no oscillations, and it's only below the horizon where your oscillations start. So if you have a detector with a very large overburden, you can, so here are your cosmic ray muons, here are your atmospheric neutrino-induced muons. This is from a fairly small data sample. If you can actually use this region above the horizon for atmospheric neutrinos, that gives you a great lever arm in terms of doing an oscillation fit, because you expect these are not oscillated. So work is underway on an analysis of 730 live days of data. In terms of a broader set of questions, one can look at the future. And the future is focused on making precision measurements of the mixing matrix. So there are a number of questions related to that in terms of determining the quadrant for theta 2-3, the other parameters in the matrix, and in particular determining if it's a normal or inverted mass hierarchy. And really, atmospheric neutrinos have sensitivity to all of these. The only question that they don't have sensitivity to, which is obviously important, are the absolute mass scales themselves. Now, so future experiments will require actually improved knowledge of both the fluxes and cross sections in order to be able to measure these additional mixing parameters. And the experimental searches will largely be based on looking at subtle matter effects. So you're looking at a very restricted range of path length and energy for various event samples. It's also obvious that the future detectors will be large on the scale of 100 kilotons to megaton. We'll explore many physics topics and not just atmospheric neutrinos. Okay. So I have a series of slides here for some of the various future detectors. So I don't have time to go through all of them, but I'll mention just one or two of them, if I may. The others are also proton decay detectors, so they'll be discussed in Chenqi's talk on Thursday on next generation nucleon decay detectors. But one that actually is not a nucleon decay detector is the India-based neutrino observatory. It's very similar to the old monolith proposal, if you remember that. The design is not finalized, but this is a possibility for it. It's something like a 30 to 50 kiloton magnetized steel block with steel of varying thicknesses and alternating planes where one can slide RPC trays. That gives you excellent timing, and the entire thing is magnetized, so one can one has very good momentum resolution as well as charge determination. And there are two sites in India currently under consideration. The real strength of this is that it allows you to explore the mass hierarchy through differences in neutrinos and antineutrinos in a certain phase space of energy and zenith angle. Okay, I'm afraid I'll have to skip these other ones. Chenqi is going to mention them in the context of nucleon decay in a moment on Thursday, as I said. So I'm sorry I don't have time to talk about them in more detail. But in conclusion, in terms of the atmospheric neutrino results, there's excellent consistency between the results from the Super-K, SUDAN2, and macro collaborations. Shown here is the SUDAN2 90% confidence interval, the final analysis for macro, and the Super-K, this is not the oscillation result that Ed was showing, but is the final Super-K1 combined analysis. The field of non-Super-K atmospheric neutrinos has now, the torch has been passed from SUDAN2 and macro to a new generation of MINOS and SNOW, and in particular the measurements of neutrinos and antineutrinos separately in MINOS will be quite interesting. Future experiments will have sensitivity to more of the mixing matrix. However, these experiments are primarily being designed in the context of future long baseline experiments, but it's an obvious point that you get the atmospheric neutrinos for free. And if you can explore this matrix with atmospheric neutrinos as well, it gives you an independent measurement of these parameters with completely different systematics. And I was given information by a lot of people, and a lot of people answered questions, so I just wanted to thank them. Thank you.